Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. Today is Monday, April 20th. It's Earth Day. This is Fanny Crawford.
And this is Stash Theokowski.
Your storytelling hosts. We're broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, and we're glad you've joined us. We have some stories lined up for you. Our theme today is flowers and gardens, which is kind of a continuation of our interview last week with Jennifer Wabnitz talking about the Shepherdstown Back Alley Garden Tour. But we might have done this anyway. It is Earth Day, after all.
Earth Day.
Stash, how's life? Do you have
life is good to report? Well, yeah, we're doing fine. Terry and I, actually, we've been out for a couple of walks together. We went to the canal, the towpath on Friday, and we walked for a mile and a half and didn't see anybody, which I was fine with. And then yesterday we went to do that again to the same place on a road just outside of Sharpsburg that leads to, it dead ends, but leads down to the canal. And when we got there, every parking space was taken. So about 20 cars and trucks. And so we turned around and came back home and went for a walk in our own town. last Sunday when we went for a ride, we had seen people along the canal, along the towpath. And this is not an exaggeration. We saw at least 60 or 70 people in a very short amount of time. And lots of those people were very close to each other and, walking both ways. Didn't see many masks. And I just put that to, there is a whole group of people now who are complaining about the restrictions. And interesting, yesterday, I know I'm going on, but yesterday I saw a very interesting thing that there were a bunch of right-wing people protesting and having somebody take their rights away to walk around without muzzles on and being masked and all this stuff. And they're just furious with the government daring to think that they can tell them what to do in their state by these governors. And it made me flash back and think, gee, they probably are supporters of Colin Kaepernick, who protested. and then I was reminded by my dear wife that they were not the kind of people that travel in the same circles as Colin. But I thought that was interesting, protesting against the government, telling them what they can do. And so here we go. And we did yard work yesterday.
Terry, there you go.
Push the mower to mow a little bit, and because we have a very small yard. And I used the weed whacker and cut down some weeds, and I felt so righteous. I don't usually do yard work. Once in a great while, I will use the weed whacker.
Okay. Well, we've been doing yard work. I've been walking almost every day. Rachel, of course, my daughter's here with us for a while, and we've been getting out and walking every day and telling stories as we walk. So it's been a good week.
I'm sure. I bet Rachel has lots of good stories.
Oh, many, many. More than you can imagine.
And there's been storytelling also. I've been watching stories. Mm-hmm. Lots of people. I missed Adam last week, but I'm going to see him this week.
Good.
He's got four lovely stories coming up, and I just watched the promo of it, in fact. and I have seen that lots of the storytellers have really jumped on the Zoom thing.
Yeah.
And are doing stories and that.
Lots out there.
And I think that's, you know, that's great.
Including yours.
Well, yeah. I've been doing some Zooming with my grandson and my daughter, who live in Westminster, Maryland, and it was pretty interesting. It was we did a strenuous kind of science math thing about pennies. There's a great experiment I used to do in chemistry with my kids about pennies. You know, there are two kinds of pennies. Did you know that?
Only two?
Well, there are two kinds of pennies from the materials that are made. Basically, any pennies you find in America now are either made out of mostly copper, about 97% copper, and that stopped in 1982 because copper got expensive and the pennies were costing a lot more than the penny to make a penny by the government. And so they switched to zinc pennies coated with a copper envelope. And it turns out the copper pennies are a good bit heavier than the zinc pennies. They look alike, you know, the zinc pennies. But there's this wonderful trick I could do in chemistry where kids could give me an empty box and I could measure the mass of that box on a balance. And then I could give them back the box and they could put any number of old and new pennies in there, any combination, and give me the box closed in front of them so I couldn't cheat and look in it. And then with a simple calculation and one measurement on the balance, I could tell them how many old and how many new pennies were in there. Only thing they had to tell me was, they could say something like, well, we put 67 pennies in there. And in just, you know, 2 minutes, I could say, well, we put in 30 of one and 37 the others.
I thought you were going to tell me you could tell them the dates on each penny.
No, I could tell them that this many were stamped with dates from 1981 and lower.
Yes.
Or 1983 and upper. And
you're not quite as clairvoyant as I was hoping you were.
Oh, well. Yeah. I missed those classes and I missed you know, Houdini's classes. I am old, but I missed those classes.
I do have to say that I've watched pieces of several of your videos, and you are charming on screen. You're just very lovable.
Terry had a very wonderful smile when I said to her after watching one of them, because I wanted to see, you know,
yeah,
how it looked. And I said, gee, I really like it that I look just like me. And she had a lovely smile.
You do. You look just like yourself.
Right. And I'm always happy with what I look like, so.
Are you ready for stories?
Sure.
Do you want to go first?
Yes, I have a nice story.
Okay.
And so far, I haven't made any terrible noises, have I?
No, you haven't, but you're not muted either.
I know, and that's good, because I didn't want to cut you off in the middle of something.
By the way, are you timing us?
I will. I forgot that I was supposed to.
Because I am, but you might have heard that buzzer go off, which okay. I was timing us backwards. I was going down instead of going up, and something
okay.
went
well,
wrong.
Okay, well, how many minutes have you been timing?
Probably about 9.
Okay, so we have to go, we want to go to 56?
Sure.
Okay. when 47 minutes come up on here, we'll be finished.
Okay.
All right. We're being very professional this morning.
Quietly. We're a little bit worse than usual.
I've been watching some things on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I think we do a better job of being I would say, not cute so much. You're cute. I don't ever look good. But I think we do a better job of the chit chat. We're more pleasant and we're not angry kind of people like so many of the people
on YouTube. I watched a YouTube video yesterday of a woman making masks, and I don't remember her name, but apparently she's a fairly well-known comedian. But she was making masks on a borrowed sewing machine, and she ran the machine through her finger.
Oh.
As well as created all kinds of other disasters. It was amusing if you knew it was staged.
There was
blood everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's a shame. Because when it's not staged and there's blood everywhere, it's interesting.
Yeah.
I have a cup that I used to just use to get water in my bathroom, and it had broken the handle off of it.
Yes.
And it was a gift. The cup was a gift. And I didn't want to throw it away even though the handle was gone. So I just, you know. And I didn't realize that the part that was still sticking off, two little stubs where the handle had been attached, there was one part that was very sharp. And I picked the cup up and I thought, gee, that feels funny. And I was starting to walk away. And then I realized that I had a palm full of blood.
Was it on video?
No.
You missed a great opportunity.
I know, because I looked and I thought, whoa, where's that coming from? Brilliant question, right? So, but anyway, it's all healed now.
All right, tell us a story. Tell us that story without blood.
A story without blood. All right.
Flowers.
Okay. There once was a king who had a great palace with wonderful gardens. In those gardens, there lived thousands of creatures from hundreds of different species. They were of great variety and color, and they turned that place into a kind of paradise that everyone could enjoy. There was only one thing in those gardens that the king really disliked. Near the center stood the remains of what had been centuries ago a huge tree. But that now was withered and dry, and it detracted from the color and beauty of its surroundings. This bothered the king so much that he finally ordered it to be cut down and replaced by a beautiful series of fountains. Sometime later, a wise nobleman was visiting the king at his palace. He whispered into the king's ear, "Majesty, you are the wisest of men. Everywhere one hears talk of the beauty of these gardens and the multitude of creatures that populate them. But since I've been here and spent time, I've hardly seen anything other than these fountains and just a few small birds. What a deception." The king, who never tried to deceive anyone, found this to his horror, that what the nobleman had told him was true. They had spent so many months admiring the fountains that they hadn't realized that hardly any animals remained in the gardens. Without wasting time, he sent for the court's experts and advisors. The king had to listen to many lies, inventions, and assumptions, but nothing could explain what had happened. Not even the great reward offered by the king managed to recuperate the royal garden's former splendor. Some years passed, and a young man presented himself to the king, assuring him that he could explain what had happened. He had heard about the beautiful gardens and visited there, and he could explain how the animals could be returned. What happened with your garden is that there just wasn't enough poo. Oh, I saw you recognize that word. Particularly moth poo. All those present laughed at the young man's joke. The guards got ready to throw him out, but the king stopped them. "I want to hear what you have to say. From the thousand lies I've heard, none have begun like that." So the young man continued, very serious. He started explaining how the garden's big animals fed mainly on the little brightly colored animals and birds who owed their appearance to their own food, composed of colorful worms, and who in turn fed on various species of plants and flowers that could only be grown in that part of the world, just so long as there was enough moth poo for them. And so he continued telling how the moths were the basis of much food for many other birds. The moth poo encouraged the appearance of new species of plants that fed other insects and animals, and in turn were vital to the existence of other species. The young man would have kept speaking without pause if the king had not shouted, "Enough! And can you tell me how you know all these things, being so young?" "Well, because now all from your garden are at my house. Before I was born, my father collected that old tree you had torn out from the middle of the garden, and he planted parts of it in our garden. Since then, every spring from out of that tree come thousands and thousands of moths. With time, the moths attracted the birds, and new plants and trees grew, providing food for other animals that in turn provided food for others. And now my father's old place is filled with life and color, all thanks to the moths from the big old tree." "Excellent," exclaimed the king. "Now I'll be able to recover my gardens, and you, I'll make you rich. Rest assured that within a week, everything will be ready. Use as many men as you like." "Your Majesty, I'm afraid that cannot be," said the young man. "If you like, I can try to recreate the gardens, but you will not live to see it. It will take many years for the natural balance to reestablish itself. With great good fortune, perhaps, when I'm old, I will see it completed. Things like these do not depend on how many men work on them." The face of the old king was sad and pensive, understanding how delicate was the balance of nature and how careless it had been to break it so happily. But he so loved those gardens and those creatures that he decided to build a huge palace next to the young man's home. And with thousands of men working on the construction, he managed to see the palace finished in much less time than would have been necessary to reestablish the balance of nature of that garden in any other place. I think you're muted. I can't hear you.
Whoops.
Oh, there you go. Well, anyway, isn't that a lovely story?
It's a lovely story, and it's perfect for Earth Day.
And I'm not even sure. I found it, and I couldn't find a, what you call it, a person to give credit to. I found it by running around on the internet looking for stories about gardens, and this was in a list, and it just and when I start reading and I saw the word poo, I thought, well, that would be a good one that would be good to tell kids for a number of reasons, because it's, I guess it's probably true in a sense, you know.
It is true.
But the important thing is that that's the kind of a word that is sort of would be considered bad in some really fancy places.
It's a trigger word,
I guess. But it is it's a word that can be used that's not too technical and certainly and not vulgar, and the kids would understand it.
Yes.
And I think this is one of the stories that I really don't know anything about gardens. You know, I'm sure you know that by now. But I do know that, you know, life in a garden depends on a series of things. And the tiny little things make the next bigger things able to grow and so on. And there's a chain, and that's throughout life. And so this, whoever wrote this story did a nice job of explaining how that works. And the king had a great solution, because he wanted to see his garden again so much. He just decided, if I can't have the garden here, I'll move my palace.
Very kingly.
And then it's also very fairy tale-y.
Yes.
Oh, that's a new word, fairy tale-y. So, and so I was really happy to have found that.
That's a great story. Thank you, Stash.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, let me remind our listeners that this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. And if you like what you're hearing or you want to hear something a little different, you can go to talltales.enlightenradio.org and hear stories from the past 3 years, I think, up there. Yes. From Stash Zielkowski and Fanny Crawford and many other storytellers as well.
Terry and I just passed our third year anniversary of living in this lovely town and this wonderful house that we rent.
There you go.
Yeah. It was the beginning of April in 2017 that we came
here. Glad to hear that.
Yep.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
I hope you stay for many, many, many more years.
I do too. I have a feeling that either myself or my remains will be here. we have no
plans. I'm looking forward to enjoying your remains, Stash.
Yes, we have no plans for moving. So,
okay. Shall I tell a story?
I think it would be lovely if you did.
Okay. Well, this one, interestingly enough, this is about a ruler as well. This is called Leah and the Apple. And I'm actually dedicating this story to my niece, Leah. There was once a sultan of Turkey who had one daughter, dearer to him than anyone and anything in the world. Unfortunately for the sultan and his daughter, she fell ill, and try as they might, not even the finest doctors in the kingdom could help her. Finally, the sultan gathered the wisest and most learned of his counselors in his council room in the old city of Istanbul. He asked when and how they might help the princess to recover. One by one, each of the counselors shook their heads sadly, admitting one by one, "I do not know." Finally, the very eldest of the counselors said, "The only thing left is to try an apple from the tree of life." The sultan seized upon that response and leapt to his feet. "What apple is this of which you speak, and where might I find it?" The eldest counselor answered, shaking his head from side to side, "My lord, I have only heard the ancient stories of this tree, but I believe it can be found in the Garden of Eden, perhaps the very center of the garden, for it has been said that two sacred trees grow there, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. The stories say that anyone who tastes an apple from the tree of life, no matter what ails her, her health will be recovered." The sultan began to pace up and down the council room. "I must find one of these enchanted apples. Which of you will help me find this ancient garden?" And the counselors, with one voice, answered, "The Jews." The eldest counselor nodded his head in agreement and explained, "It is the leaders of the Jewish people who are the experts on matters pertaining to the Garden of Eden. The stories come from their Bible, the holiest of their texts." The sultan turned to the guards at the door of the council room and shouted a command, "Bring me the leader of the Jews." In less than an hour, three of the eldest and best-known rabbis of Istanbul appeared before the sultan, wondering at this sudden and peremptory summons. The sultan met them as they entered and said, "You will have heard of the princess's deathly illness. Her only hope is in your hands. If you fail me, my anger will go hard with you." "Your majesty," said one of the rabbis, "you know we are your loyal subjects, and we'll do all in our power to help. But what is it you ask of us?" The sultan replied, "The princess is in need of an apple from the tree of life. There is no time to spare, a day or two, three at the most. If you have not brought the apple by then, all of your people will be banished. Forthwith and forever, there will be no home for you here. The Sultan waved his hand in dismissal and turned his back, covering his head with the deep collar of his silk robe. The three rabbis exited the council room, talking excitedly among themselves. They all agreed, "This is an impossible task. No one knows where the Garden of Eden might be found. And even if we were to learn of its location, how could anyone get there and back in just a day, or even three?" The rabbis called the people to synagogue and went from one shul to the next to tell the dreadful news. There was great despair, and the terrible wailing and cries of fear went up from each of those holy places of worship. Now, one of the three rabbis who met with the Sultan had no sons, but he did have a daughter. Her name was Leah. Leah, too, was a beloved child. She had heard of the illness of the Sultan's daughter and wondered who and what might be found to help her. She now understood that this was no longer an idle question. She understood the danger to her people, and she saw the deep worry lines on her father's face. That evening, she went to him and, taking his hand, said, "Surely, Father, we must not give up hope. Miracles have happened. Let us pray for one now. But tell me, is there anyone who does know the way to the old Garden of Eden?" Her father sighed. "Only the 36 righteous ones. You've heard of the Lamed Vav Tzaddikim, the 36 who hold the secrets of existence. But no one knows where they may be found." "Father," said Leah, "I've heard of an old Jew who lives alone in the forest, and there are whispers that he is a hermit and possibly one of the 36. The 36 righteous ones." The rabbi remembered that he himself had heard these whispers always before, dismissing them as idle gossip. But now it was certainly worth exploring. It was already late evening, but first thing the next morning, the rabbi and his daughter set out. It was not an easy journey finding their way through the forest, but everyone they met along the way was eager to help, and finally, just at dark, they arrived at the old man's small and primitive hut. They knocked, and as the door opened, Leah was astonished to see a luminous glow surrounding the old man's face. The hermit listened carefully to the rabbi's story and what the Sultan wanted of them. Finally, he took down a worn, ancient book from a shelf, opened to the middle of the volume, and lifted a perfectly preserved green leaf, carefully pressed between the pages. The old hermit held the leaf in his hand. "This small leaf has been pressed between these pages for more than 1,000 years. It is said to have come from the Garden of Eden. Let your daughter place the leaf beside her pillow, and she will dream of the sacred garden." The rabbi took a step back and opened his mouth to speak. No sound came out. He stared at the old man and then at his very own Leah. "My daughter?" said the rabbi, though his voice sounded more like the croak of a crow than the voice of a holy man. The old hermit said simply, "Yes, for she is the one destined to journey there." Leah and her father were mystified that the old man had given the leaf to Leah instead of the rabbi. Yet they were almost euphoric at having found this precious gift. They thanked the old man and started for home the way they had come. As darkness fell, they took refuge at an inn, and just before she lay down her head to sleep, Leah placed the ancient leaf on her pillow. To her amazement, it now gave off an intoxicating fragrance and looked as fresh and green as the day it was picked from the tree. Breathing in the fragrance, she fell asleep and began to dream. She found herself in the most beautiful garden, filled with every imaginable fruit tree and quite a few she could not have imagined. The garden was filled with such tantalizing odors and colors that she knew she must be in the Garden of Eden. She began to walk quickly, searching for the very center of the garden. She must find the sacred tree of life before it was too late. Tomorrow was the last day, according to the Sultan, that they might bring back the apple. Looking up at each ancient tree, sapling, and shrub as she passed, Leah saw an angel asleep in the branches of each one. She called to one, and the angel opened its eyes. She asked for help in finding the tree of life. The angel agreed to be her guide to the center of the garden, but Leah herself would have to choose which tree was the sacred tree of life. It seemed just the next moment that she saw before her two magnificent, very ancient trees, identical mirror images of each other, and she felt a pang of fear. They were so alike. Then she saw there was a serpent hiding in one of the trees. Clearly, she thought, that is the tree of knowledge. And the next moment she was holding in her hand a perfect ripe apple from the other, and woke to find herself sitting up in her bed at the inn. There on her pillow was a fragrant, ripe, and shining apple. She could hardly believe that she had accomplished this. And yet, here was the proof. She picked up the fruit and ran to her father, holding out the apple to him. His eyes opened wide in astonishment, and even wider as she recounted her dream to him. With tears falling on his cheeks, the rabbi hugged his brave daughter. With not a moment to lose, they set out for the Sultan's palace and presented him with the sacred apple. He too was overcome with tears of relief and himself carried the fragrant fruit to the pale, frail, and afflicted princess. He held it beneath her nose and watched with speechless joy as she opened her eyes. When he caught his breath and found his voice, he asked that she take a bite, and she did. The color came into her cheeks, and she sat up, looking around her in surprise. Within the hour, she was speaking and laughing, her usual cheerful self. The Sultan declared the day a feast day, a holiday, with a special public ceremony thanking the Jews for their part in the princess's recovery. The Sultan became a kinder, more understanding, and careful leader. He rewarded Leah and her father with their own apartments in the royal palace. Leah and the princess became good friends. Leah never tired of telling the story of her astonishing dream and the miracle of the sacred apple. The princess herself never tired of hearing the story, for she, better than anyone, knew that every word was true.
Wow. The
story was adapted from Howard Schwartz in A Journey to Paradise and Other Jewish Tales.
Well, that was really nice. And it reminded me, there's a story that I have told in the past about a pineapple. And it involves a young woman who winds up meeting a guy who has a flying rug. And they wind up in this beautiful place. And in that garden, there's a tree, a pineapple tree. I'm not even sure pineapples grow on trees, but I think they do.
No, they anyway, don't. But
they don't.
Okay.
Oh, I thought they did. Where do they grow? In the ground?
Yeah, in rows in the ground.
How about that? Okay. So anyway, but it's the same thing. They wind up getting this fruit. So maybe it wasn't a pineapple. But anyway, you get a fruit, get back on the magic carpet, go back to the kingdom, and the sultan or whoever's daughter is saved. And I think that's an example of this same basic story being told in different villages or different parts of the world.
So many languishing princesses.
Right. Yeah, it's always a princess.
Yes.
I don't know of any story where it's the prince.
There's one about another Jewish story about a prince who is languishing because he cannot find his own true love.
Oh.
Jane Wolfman tells that story.
That happens to boys all the time. All men suffer from that, you know.
I do remember that pineapple story.
Yes. Let's see. I was going to say, and you know, while you were telling the story, I think you probably noticed it was very quiet on my side.
You were listening very carefully.
Yes, I was.
And were you muted?
I was.
Is that why I
am good at taking directions. I don't always think of them on my own, but I'm good at once I'm told. So, but I was thinking, you know, this is probably not a brilliant insight, but for me, it was almost like the room lit up. You know, people are always saying, you know, don't count on tomorrow because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you might step off a curb, you hit by a bus or fall down, anything like that. And before, I would say, February of this year, if someone had, if you had interviewed me on the radio and said, tell me about your plans for the year, I would have said, oh, we have such wonderful plans. My wife is going to San Francisco with our granddaughter, who will be 10 this coming week, April 26th, and she's going to fly to Salt Lake City, pick up my granddaughter, fly. They have a whole week planned of incredible activities. And while that's happening, I'm going to go down to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, pick up my older brother, and we're going to go off to the ocean or 3 or 4 days and just have a good old man's holiday where we sit and talk and tell stories about the old days and read and of course go to our favorite restaurant. When we have a few days like this, we go to the same restaurant for every meal. And a waitress there who knows us. And she only sees us every couple of years, but she recognizes that she calls us the two old men. Which fits since we're both old men. But we also have a vacation planned at Deep Creek, renting a place for a week and having my daughter and son-in-law and my grandson John is going to be there. We've rented a boat. All this wonderful activities. And it all is gone. And it's all gone. And almost a blink, by March, we started to hear about all the things that were changed. And now in April, none of those plans are going to work. And so those wonderful things that we expect don't necessarily
happen. There'll be new wonderful things.
Yes. Well, luckily, that's something to think about. But this is a time that... just yesterday, my wife and I were reflecting that, you know, there are times in people's lives that, you know, people always say, where were you when John Kennedy got shot? Where were you when 9/11? And the children of this age are going to be, where were you in the beginning of 2020 when the world changed so much for us. How about that? That's such a serious lesson. But I think it is a good thing to reflect on that. I feel really bad for the people who aren't fortunate enough to be old and retired. You know, I mean, Terry and I are both retired, and I'm a good bit older than she is, but we are really in a nice place. We live in a very small town. It's like a ghost town now, but there are only 3 or 4 businesses in the whole town, and nobody is open except for the bakery and the tavern. And it's almost as if we're not touched by anything, because we often just stay in our house or in our little yard or go for a walk in the town, and we don't see people. We don't have people on our street who come and visit us, and we go visit them, except for the ice cream shop, where there's lots of people usually. But now there is no line in front of our house to go to the ice cream shop.
Is the ice cream shop still open?
No, it closed beginning of last week. Debbie, the owner, decided that the customers were not following the rules about staying. She had social marked on the side in her shop and on the sidewalk spacings, but there were too many people, and they were having a hard time. Without being belligerent, they were having a difficult time convincing only, I think, 5 or 6 people to be in the room at the same time. And so she decided to just close. And it's unfortunate for them, because it's their business. But it is amazing. I can sit, Terry and I sit in our front room reading, and I sit by the window, and I can't tell you the number of cars and trucks and motorcycles have pulled up and parked across the street and gotten off their bike or out of their truck or out of the car and started to walk towards our side of the street, and they stop in front of the shop, then turn around to say something to the people still in the truck or car or their partners on the motorcycles, and they look as if someone has kicked them in the stomach. It is interesting that people can be so sad over the closing of an ice cream store. And that happens sometimes when people get there too early and they are open, you know, months ago. But now it really is a sad thing to see, because the place is so popular and people come from all over. Some people travel through states to get here to get ice cream on their way someplace else, but they make detours. It is interesting how that there's something that's changed. That's, you know, we don't see the 50 or 60 people in front of our porch where we sometimes have sat and talked to people in line and hear the same thing all the time. You know, oh, I couldn't live next door to an ice cream shop. I'd be big as a house and stuff like that. So anyway.
That was a good ice cream story. good flower story, too.
It is.
Do you have
Go ahead. Noah, you had something important to say.
Well, I wanted to say that you're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. Broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Ziolkowski, the quiet one.
And we are telling stories about flowers and gardens. And Stosh, do you have another story, or do you want...
I have a personal story that when we talked about this topic, I thought to myself, I have a lot of stories that I tell about my own life. Because I'm so old, I've been around a long time, I see things and things have happened to me. And I thought, I don't have a garden. I've never tended a garden. And then I thought, that's not true. In fact, when I was in college, I met a family. my first year in college, I lived off the campus. There's a whole big story I tell about how I got to college and all this other stuff, but I lived with an older couple just at the edge of the campus. And I would walk up the road, it was a country road, through and go through the back gate of the college and then go to my classes and meals and things. And I passed three houses on my way, four houses. But anyway, it doesn't matter, three or four. One of the houses, the only one on my left side of the road as I walked, was a place where a family of a former professor of the college lived. He had died, and the college, this is in the old days, the college was so good that they let his widow stay there until she died, which was 15 years later.
Wow.
At no cost. She didn't have to pay rent or anything. She just had to maintain the place. Well, I met this lady because I met some of her grandchildren who lived with her and her daughter. And in the spring of my freshman year, 1963, I was there at the house visiting with the children who were younger than I was, except for one. And Madge, the grandmother, said, she would often address me as Ho Boy. She was Irish from the old country. She told great stories about Ireland as a girl. She had been in this country since the early 1900s, 1907 or 8, something like that. And she said, "Do you know of a shovel?" And her way of speaking was funny. "Do you know of a shovel?" And that meant, I learned, that do you know how to use a shovel? And so whenever she said, "Do you know of something?" it meant, "Do you know how to use it, or do you have one?" And I looked at one of the grandchildren, and he said, "She wants to know if you know how to use a shovel." I said, "Well, sure, I do. And she said, "Good, come with me." And so I followed her. And she was a tiny little lady. And she was already in her 80s. So I followed her to their shed and got a shovel. And she took me to her little garden and said, "It's hard for me to get the kids to help out. How would you like to help me?" And I said, "Sure, Granny," because that's what they called her, Granny. Anyway, I dug up this small garden on the side of the house for her. She wanted me to turn over the dirt. It was a simple, simple thing. But it really, until that day, I had said hello to her. She had been polite to me. But from that day on, I became like her. Oh, young friend from someplace far away, whenever I was there, she would ask me a question about, "Do you know of something?" And I did jobs for her often in her garden. I actually pulled weeds and helped her to plant a few things. And I was told by her grandchildren that her gardens never lasted very long because she would forget about them sometimes. But I never put that stuff into my head. I had made a friend. I didn't have a grandparent growing up. And I made a friend of this lady. And I loved doing things for her because she would stand there and tell me wonderful stories about the old country. And that was really something. Anyway, as I was thinking about flowers and gardens and stories, I thought, "Wow, I know a story about a garden." And eventually, for a number of years, I knew her until the day she died, for a number of years, I did gardening work for her. And I didn't do any what would be called, I guess, gardening work. I did what the hired boy would do, digging things, getting water, once, and they had a system of water underneath their main yard that was like had been made out of rocks and then covered with soil, and there was a spring, and somehow part of it had collapsed, and so the yard water would be sitting on this lawn, and it got to be mushy and you couldn't really enjoy it. And there was a time for about 4 weeks where I dug up the path of that water, and someone had built a nice, like a tunnel under the ground years ago, and part of that had collapsed, and that had blocked the water, and so, and I repaired that. And I had a wonderful time doing it. She thought it was the greatest thing in the world, and I just had a great time doing it because it was a project, and I like fixing things. Anyway, thinking about a story about gardening, and that made me think of Mrs. Norris, and she was a wonderful friend to me for about 13 years before she passed away.
What a great story.
And it's true. It's
lovely. True. I've heard you talk about Mrs. Norris before, but never specifically in the context. I think I knew she had a garden, and I remember you working for her, but this is a whole new context.
Right. Yes. And she was really a lovely person. She was very nice. She was so nice that when she found out I was going to marry her granddaughter, this was many years ago, when we went to her bedside, she was not feeling well and was resting, and we told her we had just become engaged. She used her hand to call me to her bed, to her closer, and she said, "If you're going to marry her, you can take our name, and you don't have to have that." She would say that in very lovingly, but with some kind of, I don't know. She would say, "Your last name is such a mouthful, and you can just take our name. You could become an artist." And that was one of the nicest things anybody ever did offered me.
Yeah.
Because she was very proud, a very proud Irish woman, and to offer me her name, you know.
Yeah.
And she knew I was Polish. She often referred to me as, "He's a Polak," you know. So that way I was always very touched by that. Of course, I didn't take her name.
Wonderful story.
About 3 or 4 minutes left.
Yeah, and I think my story is longer than that. Of course, it's longer than that.
Sorry.
But let's talk instead about... Oh, I had another story. Wait a minute. Where did it go?
I have an announcement.
Okay.
Today at 4 o'clock, we're going to have a rehearsal for the West Virginia Guild, Storytelling Guild, because on this coming Saturday, the 25th, I was supposed to travel to Fairmont, West Virginia for an all-day workshop and then a concert at night, a storytelling concert. And, of course, that had to be canceled because of all the rules about gathering. But we're going to do that concert by Zoom on Saturday at 4 o'clock, the same time we were going to do it in person at Fairmont.
Excellent.
At their center there. But at 4 o'clock today, a person by the name of Karen Voronch, do you know her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do know Karen.
Okay, I've never met her, but she is going to sort of So we're going to have a rehearsal the day at 4 o'clock. And so that we, she has suggested that we be dressed the way we'll be dressed on Saturday. And that we'll be there with our device, and so that she can, you know, see what we look like, and we'll tell just a couple minutes of our story, so that, you know, she can organize this. Technically, I think I know she's a storyteller, but I'm guessing that she must be also technically savvy with all this stuff, and she's going to be kind of directing this Zoom storytelling concert with four tellers. One of the tellers is not involved in this, who was going to be there in real life, and I don't know why. I have to call my friend Mike Perry, who was one of them supposed to be telling, and he's not on the list for some reason. So maybe he has another engagement or something. Mm.
Karen's a great storyteller and a great coordinator, organizing,
okay, well,
behind the scenes person.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised because Joanne Dadisman has organized this originally, and Joanne is a great organizer, mm-hmm. and you know, I've performed with her before and for her before. So, anyway, I'm excited about this. It'll be interesting. Now I have to spend the day trying to figure out what am I going to wear. You know. And I thought I had all week to figure that out, but I had months to figure it out. And now I have to know by 4 o'clock. I mean, that's not even, that's only 6 hours away.
Wear your monk's robe.
I could, but I'm going to tell the story. Do you know, have you ever heard me tell the story of the oboe?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, I'm going to tell that story.
Okay.
And that story involves me when I was
a young person,
almost, well, not quite 15, still 14
yeah.
years old.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to have to ask people to please suspend their belief, because I'll be on screen and I can't look, I might look 14 centuries old, but not 14 years old or 14 decades, I guess.
Okay. Anyway. Well, I forgot to thank Andy Alfred Irwin at the beginning of the show for allowing us to use his composition and recording of Terry Here to open the show, like we do almost every week. So I wanted to say that, and say again that if you like what you heard, you can go to talltales.enlightenradio.org to hear other stories that we've told. And other than that, I think it's time to close.
It is time to close. And I don't have my closing statement.
Well, I do.
Good. Thank you.
Somewhere in here.
Okay.
This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasz Jokalski.
Closing out the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, independent community radio in Shepherd's in Bolivar, West Virginia.
Bolivar.
That was John Case. The Enlightened Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all our own stories. What's up next, John?